This is Tuesday, April 14th, 2026. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's Continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan. We are privileged to have with us today Stephen Kane. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
May I ask when you were born?
December 30th, 1948.
And where were you born?
Lawrence, Massachusetts.
What community do you currently live in?
Woods of New Hampshire.
Marital status?
Divorced.
And do you have children?
No.
So tell us about Lawrence growing up.
Lawrence was a nice town to grow up in during the 50s. You had a lot of ethnic neighborhoods, you know, like the Polish had their neighborhoods, the Italians had their neighborhoods, the French had their, you know, and the nightclubs were there, you know. Mm-hmm. I used to go to, when I went out nightclubbing when I was younger, I used to go to the French Social Club, the Franco-Belgium Club, mm-hmm. and all these different ethnic clubs. And it was a friendly town, you know, you didn't have any problems. And then back in the 60s, the drugs came in. Mm-hmm. And when I went in the Marine Corps in 66, there was no drugs in Lawrence. I mean, I never heard of anybody doing heroin or anything, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I got back out of the Marine Corps in 1969, everybody was hooked on drugs, including my brothers. Mm-hmm. So I saw what happened. All my friends and my brother's friends were all hooked on heroin. And they tried to get me to do the heroin, but I told them no way, because I know what's, I see what's going on, you know, this is bad news. And every one of those guys that did heroin died before they went 50 years old. They died in their 30s, 40s, all of heart attacks. It does something to the heart. Mm-hmm. And they included two of my brothers. Mm-hmm. One died of pills. He took too many pills. He was a pill addict. And the other one overdosed on heroin.
So sorry to hear about that.
And they were both 49.
Wow.
When they died. They never made it to 50.
So what did your parents do for a living?
My mother worked at Western Electric. And my father worked there too. But they got divorced when I was about 8 years old, because my father drank too much, basically. He was a drunk. And I hadn't seen, the last time I saw him, I was about 8 years old. And then the next time I saw him, he was in a casket. So he was 72 years old. And I didn't even want to go to the funeral. I told my mother, I said, I don't want to go, fuck him. But I ended up going.
And I understand you spent your childhood attending parochial school.
Yeah. yeah, St. Mary's Grammar School in Lawrence with the Notre Dame nuns and the Marist Brothers at Central Catholic High School in Lawrence. I graduated from Central Catholic in 66. Mm-hmm. And then I went into the Marine Corps after that.
Okay.
There were 98%, or 97% of the people, the guy, back then it was an all-boys school, and 97% of them went to college. I went into the Marine Corps. And the brothers tried to stop me, too. They told me, don't do that, you're crazy, you know. But I did it anyway.
And, so why the Marine Corps?
A buddy of mine, I went in with a buddy of mine on the buddy plan. And the summer of 66, after we both graduated from high school, we were sitting around one day and they were showing films of Vietnam, you know, mm-hmm. and the fighting going on. And so my buddy says to me, hey, I got a great idea. Why don't we join the Marine Corps and go to Vietnam and kill some gooks? And I looked at him and I said, yeah, that's not a bad idea, you know, like, we're high school, you know, basically. Mm-hmm. So then, we never brought it up again till the end of the summer. Mm-hmm. And he was in trouble with the cops and I was having problems with my mother. And so we actually went down to the recruiter and joined. And I got to Paris Island at September 28th, 1966. And that was a shock. I mean, I don't know what the hell I was thinking, but for some reason I didn't think it was going to be that bad, you know. But then when I got there, holy shit, as soon as we got off the bus, I was almost puking. I was so scared, you know, because the DI started beating on us right away. I mean, like one guy, the DI said to one guy, he says, "Are there any questions?" And one guy raised his hand. The DI walked up to him and just belted him. And I said, "Well, I guess there won't be any more questions." So it's all psychological, though. They do it to psychologically break you down, and then they build you back up again. But it's a psychological, everything's psychological. Like the time I had to do the 4,000 jumping jacks. I was going in there expecting to get an ass beating. And all of a sudden, he's sitting there just relaxing and telling me he's tired of beating our asses, and he told me to do 4,000 jumping jacks. And everything is like unexpected. They do things that you don't expect, and it's designed to make you crack. What their whole idea is to weed out the weaklings. And we had a lot of guys that crapped out. They were gone, you know. And it got to a point with me where I wouldn't let them screw my mind up, you know. I wouldn't let them make me crack. A couple of times I came close. I mean, I was ready to just go nutty on them, you know, and then I'd be, dishonorable discharge or something like that. But I had it in my mind that I wasn't going to let them make me crack. I was going to beat them, you know. And I look back now and I think to myself, anybody that's thinking of joining the Marine Corps, no matter how bad you think it's going to be, it's going to be 10 times worse. Because if you did one day in the Marine Corps before signing up, I don't think anybody would sign up, because they'd say, "This is ridiculous," you know. But I'm glad I did it. I'm proud of the fact that I passed. I made it through there. But that was only the beginning. I mean, boot camp was tough, mentally and physically. Mm-hmm. But after that, we went to infantry training at Camp Geiger. That's a part of Camp Lejeune. And that was even worse, because they only allow you 3 hours sleep a night. And we were living in barracks, these old Quonset huts with no windows. It was the middle of December. I woke up and there'd be frost on my rack, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they only allowed us 3 hours sleep a night. The rest of the time you were out in the woods doing all kinds of shit. And the weather sucked because it was winter, cold, rainy. And I thought that was, infantry training was worse than boot camp, I thought, because you were living outside in the elements all the time, and it was just nonstop. You just went and went and went. And then after that, Vietnam was even worse than that, you know, so it was like, I thought boot camp was bad, but then I went to ITR and I thought that was even worse. And I went to Vietnam and I said, "Man, that was nothing compared to this shit," you know. So they toughened you up pretty good.
So when did you go to Vietnam?
April 16th, 1967. And I got out May 8th, 1968. 12 months, 22 days.
And what part of Vietnam did you land?
We landed at Da Nang. Everybody lands at Da Nang.
Okay.
Then you go to, after I landed at Da Nang, I went down to Hoi An, about 30 miles south of Da Nang, 20 miles south of Da Nang. Mm-hmm. It's on the coast, Hoi An. And that's where the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, CP command post was. And for the first 2 months, I did like mess duty, guard duty, all kinds of stuff that, non-combat stuff, you know. And then I was with headquarters battery then. Then they switched me to Alpha Battery about 2 months later, and I met Scott Camille, my friend, and my sergeant, F.O., and I became his radio man. And I did about 7 months F.O. on radio, carrying a radio. After my second Purple Heart, they took me out of the field because I figured it out afterwards. If you get 3 Purple Hearts, you go home. So after I got my second one, somebody told me they're going to send you home. I mean, they're going to send you back to the battery. I said, well, how do you know that? He says, everybody who gets 2 Purple Hearts in the bush goes back to the battery because they don't want you to get that third one, then you're gone, you know. They want experience. So after the second one, sure enough, I got sent back to the battery. And I spent the rest of my 6 months with Alpha Battery, with the cannons, you know.
Okay, so you became the radio man. Were you giving training in radio operations?
Yeah, we had to go to school for communication school out in Camp Pendleton, California. And part of the staging battalion, before you go to Vietnam, you go to Camp Pendleton. And I'm trying to think, wait a minute, was that Radio School of California or Camp Lejeune? No, it was in Camp Lejeune, I think. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The thing is, though, I started carrying a radio, and the radio I carried weighed 25 pounds. So I had extra weight, and plus you include batteries, it's about 30 extra pounds of weight. Then I got 40 pounds of gear on me, so you're talking about 75 pounds of shit on my back for, you know, humping through the bush for 12 hours a day, you know.
Okay. So how long were you doing mess duty or other non-combatant duties?
2 months.
2 months.
Yeah, right at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I think they do that to a lot of people. When they first get there, they give them the mess duty shit and all that kind of crap. And they kind of break you in a little bit with the hot weather and everything. When I got there, it was April. It was pretty hot. And then carrying a radio in the summertime, the temperature got up to 110. And I told one guy, I said, if you went to a pro football training camp, those guys couldn't do what I'm doing right now. 110 degrees, carrying 60, 70 pounds of shit on your back, going through beach sand. I mean, down at Hoi An, it was all beach sand, because it was on the coast. And I don't know how I did it, but I did it.
Okay, so after 2 months, tell us what happened next.
Oh, 2 months later, I was with headquarters battery, 1st Battalion, 11th Marines headquarters battery. That's the artillery battalion. So after 2 months after I was with headquarters, I went to Alpha Battery. The gun, actually firing guns, you know. And as soon as I got there, I met my buddy Scott Camille, and we hit it right off. And then Scott's radio man gets shot. And as soon as I heard that, I said, hey, man, if you're looking for a radio man, I'm your man. Mm-hmm. He picked me for his radio man. I was, next thing you know, I'm his radio man. And he left about 2 months later, though. He went back to the States because he was on his second tour of duty. Mm-hmm. So he went back to the States, and I stayed with Charlie Company, but I had different sergeants, you know. He left right after Operation Medina. He went back to the States. Mm-hmm. But I kept FO1 until around December. And December of 67. Yeah, that was just before the Tet Offensive, about a month before the Tet Offensive. Mm-hmm.
So you just mentioned Medina.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about that operation?
Yeah, that was the worst. Mm-hmm. I had nightmares for about 10 years, 15 years after I got out of the service. Mm-hmm. And every single one of them was about Medina, every one. I thought it was over. I mean, all the guys in my company, not one of us thought we were going to survive. Every one of us thought we were deadbeat because we were just too many, we were surrounded, you know. And we were surrounded by about 450 NVA. And we got about 180 guys. And after the first ambush, we lost about 15 of them. So we were down to about 170 guys when the big attack happened. And we know there was about 450 because when the North Vietnamese attack, a company attacks, they blow whistles or blow bugles. And we heard whistles, three sets of whistles, which means three companies attacking. And each company is 150 men, so you're talking 450 guys, North Vietnamese, had us surrounded. And I was hiding behind a tree stump. And I didn't know that the tree was rotted. I thought I had some good protection. And all of a sudden, the bullets started going through the tree right over my head. And I could feel the shards of wood from the tree going down my neck, and they were all hot. That's what I remember, the wood from the tree going down, mm-hmm. past my helmet, down my collar. They were hot. And I said, Jesus Christ, I said, I'm not going to last much longer. And I really don't know how we survived. I really don't. I mean, we just kept on, we wouldn't give up, but naturally, I think what happened was when Delta Company broke through, that's when things started going our way. If Delta Company hadn't broken through, we would have been all dead, without a doubt.
So let's kind of take a couple of steps back to, let's start with the reason why the Marines were in Medina in the first place.
Where?
Why the Marines were at Medina.
Well, that was our area of operations.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually the 3rd Marine Division area of operations, but 3rd Marine Division was from the DMZ down to Fubai, basically. And the 1st Marine Division was down by Hoi An and south of the, but what happened was 3rd Marine Division couldn't handle all the fighting going on up there by themselves, so they set us up. We were the first ones from the 1st Marine Division to go up there. And I knew, as soon as they told us we're going up to the DMZ, I knew I was gonna get killed or wounded. I said, because that was the worst place in Vietnam. A lot of companies getting wiped out. I mean, Bravo 19 got wiped out twice. Mm-hmm. Operation Buffalo and another operation. They were down to 20 guys. And I talked to a few of those guys. When I was up in Iceland, there was a guy from Bravo 19 that went through Operation Buffalo. And he told me the story. I mean, I mm-hmm. couldn't believe it. He said he showed me scars on his ass where he played dead. And the North Vietnamese were going, stabbing everybody. And whoever moved, they shot him. And he said, they stabbed me 3 times in the ass. He didn't flinch, didn't move, and they thought he was dead. They walked right by him. And I said, wow. I said, that is unbelievable.
Mm.
But there was all North Vietnamese Army up there, North mm-hmm. Viet Cong. So we were up against some regular troopers, not farmers, you know, with 22s. But we respected them because they had balls. But anyway, I knew as soon as they sent us up there, I said, this is it. I said, I'm gonna, and then 12 days later, Operation Medina, I got my eardrums blown out and I got my first Purple Heart there. and then I got my second one up at Quantien. I got hit with shrapnel. And Quantien was the closest base to North Vietnam. We were so far north, we were about a mile south of the DMZ. And we got hit with artillery three times a day, morning, afternoon, and evening. And you could almost time it, you watch by it, you know, it was unbelievable. And usually we got hit with about maybe 20, 30 rounds, and then it stopped because they didn't want to be spotted by, that's what was my job was. I was supposed to, when we were getting hit with artillery, my job was to stick my head out of the hole and try to figure out where the fire is coming from. And we had binoculars and we were on top of these three hills. There's three hills on Quantien called OP1, OP2, OP3, Observation Post 1, 2. I was on number 3. And whenever we get hit with artillery, everybody runs in their bunkers. We had to actually stick our heads up over the berm and kind of look for the where the flashes were coming from so we could call artillery back on them, you know. And it was like every day we were getting hit. Every single day we were getting hit with artillery. I mean, three times a day. And my bunker had about 4 feet of sandbags over it. So we had everything. We were living underground, basically. And I thought, I said, Jesus Christ, I'll be lucky if I got out of this one. But I ended up going back to the battery after I got my second Purple Heart. Just like the guy told me, he said, you're going to go back to the battery. And sure enough, I did. They didn't want me to get wounded a third time. And then they have to train a new guy. And so they, and I was glad though. I said, hey, I'm not gonna argue with them guys. I'll go back to the battery in a second. And I said, I felt pretty safe at the battery because you know, you're at a fixed base and you're not marching around the woods and the jungle. And then a Tet Offensive started. I said, holy shit. And we went right at the Way City, which was the worst place you could be. And those guns were firing 24 hours a day. I mean, I don't know how those gunners could do it, but those guns kept firing for weeks, you know, just nonstop. And we were in Way City, we were blowing up the whole city. What happened was we set up our guns at a schoolyard, and I got pictures of it too, the schoolyard. And then a week later, they moved us to the banks of the Perfume River so that we could fire direct fire right into the Citadel, right across the river, you know. So we spent the rest of the operation on the banks of the river. And then when it was all over, we went back to Fubai, and I thought it was going to be downhill from there. I said, well, you know, it can't get any worse than it's already been, you know. So, but then I went back to Fubai, and I lost my train of thought there. Anyway, yeah, it happens a lot lately. I'm getting older. But I was, my last operation was Operation Pegasus, which was 30,000 troops. And we went to clear out the Khe Sanh combat base. And they were surrounded by about 60,000 troops. And we went in there and I said, oh boy, you know, I thought I was gonna, no more operations till I got out of here. But I left Vietnam May 8th, and this operation started April 1st, 68. So the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, who I was attached to, took over for the 26th Marines at Khe Sanh. I spent my last 3 weeks, 4 weeks at Khe Sanh, and it was quiet, very quiet. The gooks had all gone. They were all dead. B-52s killed about 20,000 of them. And they all evacuated after the operation started because they couldn't take on all of us, you know. And that operation didn't go too bad for me. I mean, some of the guys got in some pretty bad fights, firefights and stuff. But because I was with the battery, I didn't have to go through that. I was with the battery with the guns now. And so all we did was we just went down Route 9, drove down Route 9 and went right into Quezon, and we set up our guns, and we relieved the 26 Marines and the rest of them. And like I said, after that, it was downhill. I had no problems at all. We had no incoming, no nothing. We were just sitting there, biding time. And then I said, well, I'm clear now. I don't have to worry about getting killed now, I don't think. And then, like I said, that picture I showed you to Paul Harrison, Pop Harrison, we call him Pop. I was supposed to go down there May 5th or 6th. And I would have stayed in his tent because we were close, you know. And the plane got delayed a day. And then when I went down there, I went looking for Pops, and his tent was blown to shit. And I talked to the guy, and he said, they're all dead. He says, everybody in that tent was dead. And I said, I should have been in that tent. I would have came down here, I would have looked for Pop Harrison, and I would have stayed the night in that tent, the supply tent. And because the plane got delayed one day, I'm alive. I should have been in that tent. I know 100% I would have been there, you know. And in fact, after that, I had 3 more days left. And all I did, I stayed inside bunkers. I said, I'm not going to go outside. I'm just going to stay in the bunker. And I'm safe in here, you know. And I spent about 2 days in a bunker before I went back home. And I didn't want to take any chances, you know. I said, after that thing with Pop Harrison, that kind of shook me up. I said, well, that's supposed to be my last day in Vietnam, and I should have been killed, you know. And I'm just so glad to get on that plane and get the hell out of there. It was like being reborn again, you know. I mean, I just, you know, it's funny too, when the plane took off, nobody's smiling. We're all kind of bummed out. And as soon as the plane left the tarmac, you know, the whole place broke into cheers, screaming, yelling. It was like, what happened, you know? All these guys that were all quiet and sad, all of a sudden, as soon as the plane lifted up, they went nuts. They realized they're gone, they're out of here, you know? And I almost extended for 6 months, but I didn't do it. I went into the office and I said, I want to extend for 6 months. And they said, are you sure? I said, yeah. And then the guy came back a day later and he says, your office refused, you know. You got to go home, you know. So I said, okay, man, I'll go home then. I'm glad I did too, because I probably would have got killed if I didn't extend another 6 months, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just, after all that other stuff, Tet Offensive and Operation Medina and all that, and I just knew that was the right choice they made, you know. They told me not to come back, just to go home. And I guess they kind of weed out people. If they think you had too much combat or you've seen too much, they'll tell you to go home. Don't. You know. If you want to sign up for Vietnam, say a year down the road, they'll do it. But they don't want you coming back after, because there's some reason they do that. I don't know why. I know some guys get accepted. They say they come back for 6 more months. But my Camille was one of them. He was there for 13 months, went home, came back for 6 more, you know. And that guy had 3 Purple Hearts. So finally he went home, and I had to get a new, FO sergeant. And I did 2 months with Camille and about 5 months with different sergeants, you know. But it was rough, very rough. I just
it was. So you're back home in Lawrence.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
When I got home, I didn't do anything I had about a 25-day leave, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's when all the drugs started coming into Lawrence. I noticed it, you know, like, and then when I got out of the service and after another year, all my brothers were hooked on the drugs, you know.
Oh, dear.
Everybody was on heroin. And in fact, Lawrence was the heroin capital of New England. Mm-hmm. So, they, you know, it was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I joined the fire department after that, after I got out, and we were the arson capital of New England for about 4 years. Yeah, we had all arson fires, you know, from the druggies fighting with each other. And I joined the fire department, and we had, in 1 year, we had 186 multiple alarm building fires. That's one every 2 days a building goes up. We had a lot of parking lots in Lawrence because after the buildings go up, they turn them into parking lots. So there was no problem parking.
You mentioned earlier in the interview that you did some duty in Iceland. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. when I got back from Vietnam, I went to Camp Lejeune, and that was in May, June, July, you know. And after about 3 or 4 months down there, sweating all, you know, just stupid stuff, inspections and marching around, all kinds of crazy shit. And I said, I got to get out of here. I got another year left. I can pick a duty station and get out of here. Mm-hmm. So I went down and talked to the guy at the office. And I says, I want something with a colder climate. I says, I can't stand this freaking heat. He says, we got an opening for Iceland next week, guarding a NATO base. And I said, I'll take it. And I went up to Iceland, and it was cool. Never got over 65 in the summer. It was beautiful. I loved it. And that was my last year. I had, after Iceland, I was discharged, you know.
Okay. At the time you were discharged, what was your rank?
Lance Corporal. What happened was I made corporal out of Vietnam. Then I went to Iceland. I got busted to Lance Corporal because I got drunk one night. You gotta remember this. We had a polo club right down the street from the barracks. So we spent our time in the club getting drunk, basically, after. Mm-hmm. So I got drunk one night, and it was in the summertime. And in the summertime, the sun never sets hardly. So it's light. So I'm leaving the polo club about 2 a.m. It's the light out. I found a can of silver spray paint on the ground. I'm walking back to the barracks. And I went and I painted the colonel's window silver. That was the most ridiculous. And I got caught only because it was light out. The sergeant of the guard looked, he was about 300 feet away. He says, hey, Kane, what are you doing? And I ran inside the barracks and I got in my bed and I put the blankets over me and I laid there like trying to think they're gonna go away, you know. And I was drunk. And so they got in my room, they got me at detention, and I denied everything. I said, I didn't do that shit. And he says, look at your shoes. And I looked out at my shoes, they were all silver. I had silver paint all over me. So they busted me, fined me $100. Something else they did too. Most of me saw $100 and they'd, 2 hours extra duty a day. So after my regular duties were done, they had me waxing floors for 2 hours after every day. I had to do this for about a month. Mm. And when I left Iceland to go home, the colonel and the first sergeant came to the airport. And I see them at the airport and they came over to me and everything. They said, Kane, we're not here to see you go by, say bye to you. We're here to make sure you get on that plane because the rest one don't leave for another week. I said, well, thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. And then I got discharged after that. You know, I went to Philadelphia and I was discharged.
Okay.
But I had a great military career up until I got to Iceland. After that, drinking and all kinds of crazy shit, just I got busted and everything. I didn't care because I was getting discharged anyway, mm-hmm. you know. But I had a lot of run-ins with the first sergeant, and they were just glad to see me go, you know. And they don't do it to me. They did it to a lot of people. Half of the Marine barracks in Iceland. Iceland had 3,000 airmen, 3,000 Navy, and 180 Marines. And we ran that place. Mm. We ran it. I mean, you couldn't do nothing without us letting you go through it. So I thought that was, out of the 180 guys in the Marine barracks in Iceland, half of us were barred from going into town because we got arrested going into town. And what I didn't know was the Icelandic people didn't like us. Mm. If you were in the service, they hated your guts. First two times I went into town, I got arrested. So that was it. They locked me up in the jail. And I found out that I was barred to the barracks for the rest of my tour of duty. So it made me feel a lot better knowing that I wasn't the only one that was barred from going into town, you know. And they didn't like, the Icelandic people did not like us. It had to do with the Vietnam thing, you know. And they hated our guts. And every time I went into town, I got into run-ins with these people. And sure enough, boom, they lock you right up and they throw you in jail. And so I was barred from going into town for the rest of the tour of duty, 11 months.
Wow. So how long did you serve with the Lawrence Fire Department?
30 years.
30 years.
I took the test and I got right to the top of the list. And I joined the fire department in 77, I think it was. And what happened was they ended up giving us a 5-year buyback, which means that the max in the fire department is 32 years. So I could retire after 27 years and get full benefits. And they did that. I don't know why they do it. A lot of that has to do with money, you know. And so I ended up retiring in 2002, I think it was, something like that, or 2004. I can't remember exactly. And I've been retired now for about 24 years maybe, mm-hmm. 22 years. And I enjoy my retirement. I love it, you know.
Okay. Now, Steve, understand that you were one of the main people interviewed for a book called Lions of Medina.
Right.
And I understand you have a copy of it.
Yeah, I got a copy right here.
Okay.
This is the first edition.
Mm-hmm.
And I checked out the Amazon. This first edition today is worth $300. If you try to buy a first edition on Amazon, it's $300.
And you also have a couple of autographs and notes.
Yeah, I got an autograph from the author of the book right here. What happened was, I went to the Las Vegas reunion back in 2005, I think it was, and Doyle Glass was there, the author. And they got us into a room with all the guys that were on Medina with Charlie Company, and they interviewed us. And this went on for 2 days. And that's the signature. That's
if you can hold it a little bit higher. Yeah, that's it. Thank
yeah.
you.
Mm-hmm. And I'll read it to you. This is from Doyle Glass. It says, it has been a true honor to write about the Marines of Charlie 1-1. What they and Delta Company did on the night of October 12, 1967 is already a part of Marine Corps history. All of you are true heroes, warriors, and patriots. And then main character, basically, Lieutenant Ruffa, he's the guy that sang the hymn. He sent me this, he autographed it right here for me,
okay.
too.
A little higher, that way. Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll read it to you. It says, September 15, 2007. That was at the reunion after the Las Vegas reunion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in Washington, D.C., I think. But anyway, it says, to Steve, I was privileged to lead some brave young Marines on Medina, and they are the reason we prevailed. They are the ones who deserve to be remembered as the heroes of Medina. They are and always will be my heroes. Had they been lesser men, I doubt any of us would have survived. And you, Steve, you were one of these heroes. Well done, Marine. Thank you. Semper Fi, Jack Ruffley, Major USMC.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that brought the value of this book up to a little more than $300. But when I first heard about the book, mm-hmm. I thought to myself, well, it'll probably be another grade B book about Vietnam, you know. And when it came out, it won an award mm-hmm. for the military history division, I think of, I figured who it was. Doesn't matter. But the book, all the reviews were 5 stars. Every single mm-hmm. review I ever saw was a 5-star review. And I said, wow, this book is pretty good, you know. And I read it, and I bought a bunch of copies, paperback copies for friends and people who are interested in that stuff. And when the book came out, I bought 50 paperbacks. I didn't, I said, I'll get 50 paperbacks that way. And I ran out of them about a year ago, 2 years ago. And I had to reorder. And that's when I found out that this book is worth $300 now. And I went, holy shit. I said, I never mm-hmm. realized that it could be that expensive, you know?
Mm.
But I ended up, I went to about 10 reunions altogether
mm-hmm.
over time. And I don't go to them anymore because all the guys are dying off. Ruff is dead. He died a few years back.
Oh.
And most of the guys I know passed on. And the reunions kept getting smaller and smaller every year.
Yeah.
And I reached a point where I said, I'm not going to go anymore.
Okay. Now, Steve, excuse me, before Lions of Medina, did you ever talk about your experiences while you were in Vietnam?
Not really. It's too hard to talk about it. I sort of went into a shell, you know, because back then Vietnam wasn't popular anyway, and I went out to my visiting relatives one time with my mother, and I think it was Christmas or something, and the subject of Vietnam came up, and the whole room went quiet. Everybody shut up. They stopped talking. It was like nobody wanted to hear about it. So I knew then that it wasn't a popular subject, you know. And I didn't want to start talking about it because it's I get too emotional, you know. Mm-hmm. You start getting choked up and stuff. And I went to the VA about 30, 40 years ago and joined the Vietnam group in Lowell, Massachusetts, at the VA in Lowell, Mass. And that group is still together to this day. I still go every Wednesday. In fact, I'm going tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Every second Wednesday of the month, the Vietnam guys get together. And I started that 30 years ago, and that helped me an awful lot because I ended up with their help and all the knowledge of the talking to all these guys, I ended up getting 100% disability for my wounds, you know. And before that, I only got, I think I had 30% disability for my ears, because I got my eardrums blown out, 30% tinnitus and hearing loss and shit like that. But I found out that I could get PTSD. And so I probably have it. I mean, I was having problems, you know. That's why I went to the Lowell VA and joined the group, because I wanted to talk to people that were there And it was the best thing I ever did because I got a lot of help with military stuff and with my mental health too, you know. Mm-hmm. And the military stuff, after 10 years, I ended up getting 100%. And I went, wow. So they gave me 70% PTSD. And the one rule about the VA is they reject you almost all the time. You put in a claim, they reject you. But I found out through the group, my group, that you keep appealing, keep appealing, keep appealing. I kept appealing for 10 years, and I finally ended up getting it. And if it wasn't for that, I'd be still at 30%, you know. And there's a big difference between 30% and 100%. So I, but all my, when I first got out of the service, like I said, all my nightmares were driving people crazy. I mean, when I was married, my wife had to sleep in the other room because I'd be flipping out. I'd be like tearing the sheets apart. And I used to have them almost every night at first, when I first got out. But then I, over time, I don't have them anymore. I very rarely have a Vietnam dream that spooks me, you know what I mean? But when I first, like I said, at first it was every night, you know, every night. It was always all about Medina, every one, you know. Just when the second ambush started, it's always that, hiding behind a tree with a hot embers going down my back. And I wake up and I'd be shaking. And I can't even talk about it.
Okay, that's okay, Steve. I mean, we thank you for sharing your experiences during what must have been perhaps the most traumatic time anyone could ever experience.
Well, it was bad, very bad.
Aside from the Vietnam group, at the VA, did you join any military service organizations such as the Legion or VFW?
Yeah, the VFW. I'm still a member of the VFW up in Hillsborough, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And but I don't go there anymore. I when I first moved up there about 13 years ago up to New Hampshire, I used to go there and I'd sit down, I'd shoot the shit with the guys, you know, and but I didn't drink. Mm-hmm. So after a while, I just said, I stopped going there, you know. I mean, it's just, I still pay my dues, mm-hmm. but I don't go there, you know, because it's, it got boring in a way, you know. I mean, I'm a patriotic guy, but I just realized that, most of the time it was all drinking things, you know what I mean? Everybody's drinking, they're having a meat raffle, everybody's drinking, they're all drinking. Mm-hmm. And it didn't bother me that much at all. I mean, I could sit in the bar room all day long and smell booze, and I wouldn't be tempted at all to drink. I haven't had a drink in 26 years now, and I'll never drink again. I'd know that for a fact. I'm not even, there's no way I'd ever drink again. I mean, when I compare my life to when I was drinking to now, it's like night and day, you know. When drinking causes more problems. That's why I was divorced, the drinking. We were both drinkers, me and my ex-wife, we were both drinkers. And that's what ruined it. I think we lasted a year. And that was the problem right there, drinking. But I never remarried because I figured at the time I was drinking heavy. And I said to myself, who's going to marry me? I mean, I'm, trouble follows me around, you know what I mean, because of the drinking, naturally. I mean, I had more run-ins with the Lawrence cops. Jesus Christ. They used to actually, if they caught me drinking, this was back 30 years ago, 40 years ago. If they caught, we had our own club, the Fireman's Club. And the cops used to go there too. So now I whenever I get pulled over by the Lawrence cops for drinking, they wouldn't arrest me. They take my keys off me, and they didn't know who I was. They take my keys off me and they say, you can pick them up tomorrow morning at the station. And I'd walk home. But Lawrence wasn't that big, so I could walk anyway, you know.
Right.
But I was pretty popular with the cops. They all knew me. And that's why I quit drinking, too. But not only my health. They told me I had 5 years to live if I kept drinking. But I was so sick of getting into trouble, you know. It was always one problem after another, you know. I got one OUI in my life that they bagged me for. But that was the Salisbury Beach cops up in Salisbury Beach. And they don't—they didn't know who I was or anything. They just arrested me, locked me up, and I got bagged. But that was the only time. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, that's amazing, because I was drunk a lot, driving drunk a lot, and I only got bagged once. That's amazing.
It is. Yeah. It is. So, Steve, what kind of medals and or commendations did you receive for your service with the Marine Corps?
Two Purple Hearts, two Presidential Unit Citations. That medal I was talking about, the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, I never even heard of it. I think they picked that out, like I said, out of a hat, you know. And they, let's see. Combat Action Ribbon, National Defense Ribbon. And I think that's about it.
Okay.
We got the Presidential Unit Citations for Way City. And what was the other one? Oh, Quezon, mm-hmm. Operation Pegasus, where we cleared out Quezon. So we got two Presidential Unit Citations. And that's impressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not like the Cross of Gallantry, whatever that is. I didn't even know. I asked the guy, I says, what are you giving me this Cross of Gallantry for? He says, we don't know. They pick them out of a barrel, you know. They pick their names out of a hat. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, I get it now. Okay.
Okay. Okay, Steve, we're almost ready to wrap up this interview, but I just wanted to kind of circle back to Medina. You mentioned this a couple of times when someone started singing the Marine Corps hymn.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
After the second ambush, the big one, after about maybe 2 hours into the battle, you know, and we're running low on ammo too, and all of a sudden I started hearing this singing noise, like the Marine Corps hymns, singing the Marine Corps hymn. And I thought to myself right away, I said, somebody cracked up, you know, somebody's gone bonkers off the deep end, they've gone. And then I heard it louder, got louder, and then I realized our guys were singing this shit. And I said, man, you're singing a Marine Corps hymn, I can't believe it. And I just listened, I didn't sing it, because I was just in shock. I said, they're singing the Marine Corps hymn? I said, you gotta be kidding me. But, you know, it kind of brought up our spirits a little bit, because it made us, it was a plus for us. Everything was going downhill all the time, and that was the first good thing that happened. And when it happened, everybody kind of felt a little better. I mean, you know, it was like it was a very smart move on his part. I thought if I was in his shoes, I wouldn't have known what to do, you know. Mm-hmm. But when he started doing that, he started singing that hymn, like I said, I couldn't believe it. I said, you got to be shitting me. How the hell can this guy be singing? I'm too scared to even open my mouth, you know. And I think the gooks must have flipped out too, because here they are. They got us outnumbered and everything, and we're running out of ammo. And they figure we must be freaking out. And then all of a sudden we start singing to him. And I think that psychologically made them wonder what the hell is going on here, you know. These guys are singing. They should be scared to death, you know. But they're singing the hymn. And then after Delta Company broke through an hour and a half later, Delta Company broke through, and when they broke through, I started to think that we're going to make it, you know. And they started handing out magazines of ammo to us. I got 4 magazines of ammo right off the bat. And I had 17 rounds left. And I was on my last magazine, I had 17 rounds left. But I didn't want to use them spraying in the darkness or whatever, you know. So I said, I'm going to wait here, wait for them to come to me. And I started thinking, because the first counterattack they made, I went on it, and I was so scared. It was like when I got up to stand up after 2 hours on my belly, the first thing that entered my mind was my life expectancy just went down to seconds, and I was expected to be killed immediately. So after the first counterattack, I went back to my tree there where I was hiding behind, and what the hell was it? I decided then not to go on any more counterattacks because I was just wasting ammo, basically. And I had 17 rounds left, and I was saving them so that when they, in fact, I even yelled at them. The gooks were yelling, "Marine, you die tonight, you die tonight," you know. And some of the guys were yelling back and saying, "Ah, fuck you, you know, Ho Chi Minh sucks," all kinds of stuff, you know. So then they said it again, "You Marine, you die tonight." And so I yelled out as loud as I could. I says, "Come and get us, you fucking gooks. What are you waiting for?" Okay. And the guys next to me were going like, "Shut up, shut up." They're telling me to shut up. But I as soon as I said it, I heard all the guys say, "Shut up, shut up," because they didn't. And I stayed quiet after that. But I got my point across to the gooks, you know. And right after that, Delta Company broke through, and we got our all kinds of ammo then. And that's what I told Camille. I said, "I think we're going to make it." And we all felt like there was some hope, you know what I mean? And then when I saw the Gatling guns, the Spooky, the Puff the Magic Dragon, they called them in. And I heard the planes overhead. They said, "That's Puff." And all of a sudden, the freaking bullets came down. And they fire 6,000 rounds a minute. So 3 Gatling guns on the plane firing 6,000 rounds a minute. And what they did was they had to wait till after the third counterattack. They kind of pushed the gooks back. And then when the Puff came, they were away from us farther enough where it was safe. They wouldn't hit us. And all of a sudden, they kept on spraying the whole area in front of us for about half an hour, just going over it. And I told Camille, I said, "You know, I said, there's a lot of gooks dying out there right now. I said, there's a shitload of them out there. We had 2 regiments in our area." And I says, "And they're mowing them down like nothing, you know." And you know, it's like a tracer, just a line of red going down on the ground. And when I saw that, I said, "We're going to make it." I knew we were going to make it then. And after that, I was medevaced the next day, though, because of my ears. And Camille ended up carrying the radio back to the base when they walked back, you know, when they walked to the choppers and everything. So I lucked out in the way. I got one of the last choppers out, and I didn't have to do any more humping or anything. And once I got on that chopper, I said, "Man, I made it. I'm out of here," you know. And that was the absolute worst operation. And I really don't know how we made it out of that alive, but we did, you know.
Okay, Steve, before we wrap this up, how important was it for you to serve in the military?
Well, my uncle served in World War II. Mm-hmm. My grandfather served in World War I. In fact, my uncle was when the Japs surrendered to MacArthur there in Tokyo Bay or wherever it was, he was there.
Wow.
My uncle was there. He says, "I was on one of those ships where they surrendered." And so it was, you know, it was type military type family, you know. And I didn't want to go in the military. When I was a kid, I used to see these war movies. And then my mother told me, you could be drafted someday, you know. And I said, they're going to make me go there? You know, and she goes, yeah, and I was freaking out. I'm saying, oh, no, I don't want to do that crap, you know. I was only about 8 or 9, you know. And then as I got older, I started thinking that might be a good experience too, you know. And then my buddy, he's the one that really talked me into it. He was a little nutty, let's put it that way. And he talked me into joining with him on a buddy plan, basically. And I don't see the guy. I haven't seen him since Vietnam. But he was a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble. I got in trouble because he fucked up, you know. Like when we were at boot camp, he screwed up, and the DI said, "Well, did you come in on the buddy plan with they call him a platoon psychopath because he had a twitch, he had a little twitch," and the DI told him, "You're not in the position of attention if you're twitching," so he became known as a platoon psychopath. And one day the DI says, "Did you come in on the buddy plan with anybody?" They said, "Yeah, Private Kane, sir." Private Kane, front and center. "Why did you bring this psychopath into my Marine Corps?" That was it. I knew I was going to get an ass kicking. And any time he got into trouble, I had to go get in trouble with him because they called me up for bringing him into their Marine Corps. Mm. Part of the psychological thing, you know. And I told him one day, I said, "Look, you asshole." I said, "You keep fucking up like this, I'm going to kill you in your sleep." I told him, "I'll strangle you while you're sleeping, you bastard." I got so mad. And it ended up, he got taken to the motivation platoon, which is, they don't have it anymore. But that's a platoon where they just, from all day long, you're carrying pails of sand. They got like one big sand pile about 30 feet high over here. And you have to fill up your pails and walk over to there and put it over there. And when that's done, you bring it back. And you did this all day long. Mm-hmm. It was like torture, really. And he ended up going there. And after that, they never bothered me again for some reason when he got in trouble, you know. I joined because of him, basically. I probably would have gone on the service, but I don't know if I would have gone on the Marines either, you know. But he was the nut that, you know, it's funny. They tell you when you join, you're going to stick together the whole time, you and your buddy. That guy was gone after boot camp. I never saw him again. there's a lot of crazy stories. I mean, I could, it's so many weird shit. So much weird stuff, you know. Like, I could actually write a book. I mean, really. Well, I'm sure other people have already. So.
Steve, is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap things up?
Thank you for having me. You know, mm-hmm. I appreciate it. I also did one of these down in Florida. Mm-hmm. When I went down to see my F.O. Sergeant Scott Camille about 15 years ago, first thing he did, he took me down to the University of Florida at Gainesville, and someone like you interviewed me, Vietnam thing. And I got the thing at home, and they asked me a bunch of questions too, you know, the same thing. So went on for about 45 minutes. And so this is the second time I've actually had an interview.
Well, Stephen Kane, we thank you for recording your experiences for a second time, yeah. And this time for the Natick Veterans Oral History Project.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me.